Hello and welcome to The Family of Things, a podcast series exploring ideas, life, and how we live it. I'm Helen Shaw, and in this series, I'm going to meet people who are living life with passion and ambition to talk to them about their story and their life journey. And this time, I'm with a very soundful woman, composer Linda Buckley, whose work has been described as both strange and beautiful. And Linda says her inspiration can come from the sound of everyday things and places, like a gate creaking or the wind on sea, triggering inner songs which she weaves into intricate and often otherworldly pieces. Linda, welcome. It's such a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you very much, Helen.
And Linda, this idea about sound, a world full of sound which shapes your music, a lot of it comes from where you come from. And I opened Google Maps this morning and I went to the head of Kinsale. And I guess if I looked closely, I could have seen the farm where you grew up on. What was it like?
It's a very, very special place. It really feels like the edge of the world. The land that we have on our dairy farm is right on the coast and just below the lighthouse. So I always remember hearing sounds of foghorns when I was growing up, and also things like milking machines, which was very much part of my everyday musical sonic landscape. There was a wildness to living there and growing up there too. It's really not a sheltered place. It's very difficult to grow trees and plants there. It's very kind of barren in a way. And I think there's a beauty to that.
You're cut off and you're looking at that head jutting into the sea. So a wild open space. But you weren't alone. It was a big family.
Very big family. I'm the youngest of nine children. And there was a great sense of us being cut off in a way from the rest of the world, but having each other. So we were all very close growing up.
And was this a musical family? I mean, nine siblings, close enough in age?
Very close in age.
And music, how much was that part of your home?
Well, four of us now actually do music full time.
That's
which
incredible.
Is quite a big statistic out of nine.
That's incredible from one family.
It is, I suppose, quite unusual. My father played the accordion and sang, so I always heard him growing up singing traditional music and folk songs. So that was my first introduction to music, really. It wasn't through classical music at all. It was definitely traditional at first.
So everyone sang first before they played. Is that right?
Pretty much. We would always sing harmonies with each other. And I think there's something very special about siblings singing together. And there's a natural sense of phrasing. And even when I sing with my sisters now, we don't have to look at each other for cues or for entries or anything like that. We just naturally breathe together and everything lines up. And there's something really beautiful about hearing people who know each other very well sing together.
And in growing up in that environment and listening to sounds, did you have a sense as you started to sing and play music, I guess play the piano, did you start to see yourself as a musician and a composer?
It was always part of my life, so I never really felt that this is definitely the direction I was going to go in. Actually, when I was very young, I was really interested in writing. I used to always write poetry and short stories, and I used to go missing, and my older brothers and sisters would find me behind a tree, and I'd be deeply immersed in a book, and they would have been calling me, but I wouldn't have heard them because I was so immersed in this other world. I always loved books growing up, and I think that sense of just being in another world, which I think is something that interests me in music, in entering another world.
And the influence of your dad, very clear. Celtic music, Gaelic music, Seanó's singing itself has carried into your composition today. When you think about yourself as a musician, are you a singer first before anything else?
Well, I think when you grow up singing, it's such a deep part of yourself that it's something that you carry throughout your life. And even when I'm composing now, I'm always singing as I'm composing because I feel that that's the most kind of primal instinctive part of me. And anything that I'm writing, I feel if it works well in the voice, then it will work probably well in melody instruments and things like that. So I'm always thinking of harmony and voices and how they interact and melody and things like that as well.
So you're singing as you write the notes?
Always.
And What about your mum? Was she a singer?
She definitely wasn't. She's tone deaf. When she hears music or when she hears pitches, she will sing them back in completely random orders. And I've never really heard anyone else sing the way that she has. It's a very unique style. And so she would sing very unusual nursery rhymes to us when we were children. She would make up her own little songs, which would sound probably very strange to anyone else. But for us, there's something very beautiful about them. And then years later, I would go into school and sort of be singing them in class and getting very strange looks because they sounded so unusual, I guess.
So the journey from the head of Kinsale to not just here in Dublin, but where you've travelled right across the world, composing and being part of performances in amazing orchestras. How does that happen? Where did you get the courage to be a composer?
That's a really good question, actually. And it's something that I have thought about over the years, because it does seem like a very unlikely thing to happen, coming from that place, which is so far removed and so remote, and coming from a farming background into something that is deeply rooted in kind of experimentation and electronic music and all that kind of thing, which in some ways feels like more of an urban scenario to be delving into. Well, I think one of the first things that was instilled in me was a really strong work ethic from my parents. They work really, really hard, and they're in their 70s now and they still work on the farm. So I always felt the importance of really working with something and sticking at it. And if you found something difficult, to really practice at it or really try to get better at it. And this was from pretty much kind of the teenage years. Even though I was studying piano, I probably wasn't so committed to trying to replicate other people's music perfectly. I felt a little bit stifled by that. I wanted to explore other things and other sounds. So I started to play my own harmonies and play my own little improvisations on the piano. And I would sometimes try to notate sections of them, and I'd bring them in to a very inspiring teacher I had in secondary school called Mary Lorden, who really instilled in me that I had something and that I could work with it. So she was one of the first people outside of my own family that really told me, you have something here and you should do something with it.
It's amazing. In this series and talking to people about their life journey, I think everyone has referenced one good teacher and somebody who at one point said, I believe in you, you have potential. But what music were you listening to? What music was influencing you in your head? And what was turning you into acoustic electronica or the different music that you've now begun to invent?
It was very much apart from the piano music that I was learning for my grades and my exams and all that. And I'm so glad that I did that and had that training. But I wouldn't necessarily have sat down and been listening to this music at all. A lot of it came from my older brothers and sisters, and they would bring records into the house. They would bring things like the Cocteau Twins, Kate Bush as well, who I really had a massive passion for at a very young age. And it inspired me to read the book Wuthering Heights when I was very, very young. It's probably too young to really understand it fully. Probably about the age of 8 or 9 or something like that.
8 or 9. Wow. Wuthering Heights is pretty dark for an 8-year-old.
I think just the sense of strength and the sense of very unusual arrangements in her music, and that she's not afraid to push the boundaries. And a lot of the music really blurred the boundaries between kind of avant-garde music, soundscapes, ambient electronic music, Bulgarian vocals. Like, it was just all these different worlds colliding, and I felt it was really exciting.
If you're 8 or 9 listening to the 17-year-old Kate Bush, what you're saying is you were already beginning experimenting with notes or composing. Do you have a sense of what you were composing at that stage? Wouldn't have used the word, probably, but were you inventing your own music?
I was making up little tunes, but I was, at that time, I was very interested in inventing in other ways, like poetry and things like that, actually. And then I think the music came a little bit later than that. And I never would have used the word composer, actually, until much later.
And why is that? I mean, did you feel as you were progressing from secondary school onwards that there were role models for a woman being a composer in Ireland?
Not really, not at that time, actually. The only contemporary classical music from Ireland I would have heard at the time would have been set works that would have been on The Leaving Cert and things like that, and would have been actually John Buckley at the time, who is no relation to me now, but I know him and he's a friend. But, and his great piece, Sonata for Unaccompanied Violin. And I remember thinking there was something very interesting about that, and it's quite experimental, but hearing new sounds being made on the instrument. And this was before I had ever tried to do anything like that myself. So there wasn't really a sense of strong role model from female composers yet at that stage. And now, you know, I would be very interested in people like Kaija Saariaho and Julie Wolf, and going as far as back as Hildegard von Bingen, who's like the first female composer that we know of from medieval times. So this is so interesting to me that now I can see a sort of a legacy from that, but it wasn't apparent to me at that age.
And I know from your perspective that you see this arc linking from medieval music to where you are with acoustic, electronica, and quite experimental work now.
Well, absolutely. I feel that I'm drawn towards certain traits in music, and a lot of the time it's to do with things like harmony, to do with atmosphere, a sense of immersion, a sense of being enveloped by a feeling or by this kind of harmonic wash over you. So a lot of the music that I would write or that I would listen to probably sort of taps into that sense of creating atmosphere, which I really get from medieval music. I mean, there's so much music from the 14th century, especially people like Leonin, Perrottin, and Masho, which is all about very pure, clean lines, but performed in cathedrals and churches. So you get that lovely kind of reverberation, and that's something that I've always connected with.
And in many ways then, you feel less affinity with the stuff in between.
I would say so.
You're not really the one going to be rushing to see Wagner's Ring.
No, I really wouldn't. I mean, there's a lot about that music that I can learn from, and I definitely can see why people listen to it, and it's very impressive. It does have great emotional impact for a lot of people, but it doesn't really speak to me in a personal way. And I remember speaking about this with my dear friend Bob Gilmore, and he said, you know, why would we be listening to just music from dead white European males? And he has a point that there's so much other music out there, not just in the Western world as well, but, you know, looking into Indian music or Indonesian music and all this other music that I'm interested in. And for me, that's just one path in music, and it's one of many.
And the path that opened for you when you went to UCC and music there exposed you to those influences, say from Java or from beyond Europe. UCC was a place where you began to meet people who opened your ears, effectively.
I have distinct memories of the first few days of starting college in UCC and feeling so excited and feeling so happy, and just the sheer diversity of what you could learn, from Shano singing to medieval music to Steve Reich to gamelan. And I remember when the gamelan first arrived to Ireland, it was 1995, and it was before I started college.
And maybe just explain what the gamelan is.
I know this term, you probably use a lot, gamelan, and not everybody has come across it. Gamelan is a collective term for a group of instruments from Java, Indonesia, usually very percussive instruments, often made of bronze, a lot of gongs, also fiddles and flutes and things like that, and vocals, and often a very hypnotic, mesmerizing music that kind of cycles back in itself. So there's a sense of always returning and returning and turning, and patterns that are layered on top of each other. So it's a very atmospheric music often.
And I guess this was at the point when you're working with Mel Mercier.
That's right.
So what type of work did it lead to?
Well, I started to learn it. And the great thing about studying gamelan or learning gamelan is that you don't just learn one instrument. You learn how to play all of the instruments in the orchestra, which is very unusual. I mean, that would be unheard of in a symphony orchestra here. And that's how it would be done naturally in Java, in that sense that you can hop from one instrument to another. So there's that lovely feeling of there's no hierarchy, that you can move between instruments. There's no sense of soloists. It's everybody's equal. And I always loved that about gamelan. I think that kind of influenced a lot of the other music that I went on to write. Later on, I started to write music with Mel Mercier on the gamelan. And a lot of it is so hands-on. It's not like you're working in isolation on paper. You're working with the instruments, and it's very concrete, it's very tangible, and there's something very kind of spontaneous about working with the instruments in that way, and it feels a little bit more improvisatory.
But it is still scored?
A lot of it would be scored in the end, but in terms of working out ideas, you would be physically trying them out on the instruments.
Tell me a little bit about Mel Mercier and the influence he may have had on your work and just in your thinking.
It was really a sense of openness, a sense of breaking out of a narrow view of music being within one thread, that it could be in multiple threads and it could influence your own music. And of course, he's very active as a composer too. And I have since worked with him on theatre projects. So it was just a feeling of a kind of a positive energy about it too, that music is joyous and it wasn't about locking yourself away with a piano for 9 hours in a room. It was about embracing working with other people and I suppose the harmony of everyone making music together. And there's a really beautiful energy about that. And you feel that when you walk into the room and you're playing gamelan, it's just this connection between people.
And from UCC, you went to Trinity. And I suppose, in a sense, you're beginning to see a path of composition emerge. But that's where you would have met Donacha Dennehy.
That's right. I met Donacha Dennehy before I went to Trinity, actually, while studying at UCC. He came to do a concert with the Crash Ensemble. And they were very new at that time. They had just been set up maybe 6 months previous to this. And I was really struck by his approach as well to music. And in a way, in a common thread, almost from Mel, a sense of a joyous energy about it, that it was something to be really excited about.
And it's worth framing that at that stage, what people like Mel Mercier or Donacha Dennehy were doing was quite different. It's quite a radical sound opening up, but also the lines were blurring.
I think there can be sometimes a sense that music written at university is something that has to have a very strong academic leaning. And I felt that the music that I was listening to or the concerts I was going to maybe were sometimes at odds with studies of very serious harmony and counterpoint and things like that. And they're very good tools to have as a composer, and I'm really glad that I have them. But I felt that at this point, the lines were definitely becoming blurred. And I was really drawn into this. And you see it now with people in America, like the Bangin' a Can All-Stars in New York, David Lang, Michael Gordon, and Julie Wolf, who I later studied with. And the feeling that, you know, you could go and listen to goth punk music, and then you could also listen to a string quartet. And why do they have to be in completely opposite worlds?
And in some ways, that's a really rich way to think about music, that everything can literally bounce off each other. I'm wondering, when did you come out as a composer? When did you feel it was okay to say, when you met somebody at a party and they said, "What do you do?" "Hey, I'm a composer."
I still sometimes actually don't use that term. I would say I write music. But I don't know. It's not that I don't feel comfortable with that term. I just think that sometimes it's weighted with such association and it makes people think of, obviously, Beethoven and Mozart, and, you know, that it's not a current kind of job description in your everyday world. But it is what I do, so.
And when you were doing your PhD, say, in composition at Trinity, what were those early pieces that you were composing and performing?
A lot of them actually were purely electronic, and others then were purely instrumental. And I started, I suppose, within my PhD to bring both of those worlds together. And I started writing a lot for live instruments with electronic elements and trying to find connections between them so that maybe, you know, the sound of a viola can sound a little bit almost like a record needle scratching on vinyl or something like this. That, you know, there's ways of taking sounds even from the everyday world and making them connect with instruments. And this all really fascinated me. And also through my studies with Dermot Furlong at Trinity College in psychoacoustics, that sense of sound and perception and how do we process sound. And I was really interested in that as well.
Yeah, because do you remember The Planets, which is been performed quite a lot this year alone, and an amazing piece. But when you were talking about that creaking or squeaking noise, it's very much there in the viola. And in a sense, something like that, like the Do You Remember the Planets, when you think about writing that or composing that, take us through how that happened.
I It can differ depending on the piece that I'm working on, but often what happens, and I'm always really glad when it does happen, is I imagine a sound in my head and it's often very fully formed, and I can hear different strands within it and I can hear different harmonies and sounds. And then it's a matter of trying to transcribe what I've heard in my head. It's almost like remembering a dream. Sometimes it's not so easy to get a handle on because it feels like it's something in the ether and you're trying to remember elements of it. So that could be things like harmonies or it could be little sounds. And this is very much how Do You Remember the Planets started. I was imagining the viola as being some super instrument that was kind of trailing off into other worlds. And so that's the idea behind it first, was this idea of the music of the spheres, which is something that I love as a concept, the idea of planetary motion and smaller planets rotating at high frequencies and bigger planets rotating at lower pitches, lower frequencies, combining together to create this beautiful harmony, the music of the spheres. I love the idea of it in Pythagoras and that sense of harmony of the universe in a way.
I've heard you use the word oral hallucinations, which sounds a bit painful, but is that how it starts, that you hear a sound and then it's how do I manufacture that sound?
It often is. And then it's a question of trying to translate that, whether it be through electronic means. And, you know, this is the thing that often I talk with people about, is they sometimes have this association of electronic music being kind of cold and clinical and emotionless. And for me, it's the opposite. You know, it's about transforming the sounds even around us or for instruments into something that is deeply emotional often and personal to me. So with that piece, the planets piece, everything in the electronic parts of it are all derived from viola itself. So everything comes from that, and just various manipulation of the viola sound and then layering to create a kind of a sense of spinning into the other spheres.
And Linda, just helping the outsider on this, because the word that's used around your music is spatial music. What is spatial music?
Well, spatial music is a term that a lot of people associate with very recent developments in technology, the availability of multiple speakers in a space, in a room, so that new music can be presented not in mono or stereo, but in 4 channels or 8 speakers. And that's just one kind of way of looking at it. But the lovely thing about spatial music for me is that it has such earlier precedence into history. And this is to do kind of with spatial aspects of buildings and architecture. St. Mark's Cathedral in Venice in the 16th century would have had spatial music presented in a very interesting way, with choirs on opposite galleries singing to each other. And they were called the chori spezzati, which is separated choirs or spatial choirs. And sometimes you would have different instruments like trombones and horns playing towards each other across the cathedral and creating these very interesting effects. So you might have one phrase on coming from one side and then they would finish, and then you would have a phrase coming from the other side, and all this lovely kind of interaction between, almost like left and right, like stereo panning effects, but happening in live situations.
It's wonderful. So in many ways, again, going back to roots and coming back to how we experience sound in the real world, in a natural environment where it's coming from different sources. So there is that environment of playing to the human body or our own ears, in a sense, of what is before and behind us. But from your own challenges within this, when you think about creating spatial music, is it therefore very driven by the venue?
It can be. And a lot of the time when I'm writing spatial music, I'm thinking about where will it be performed and how to spatialize performers. So a lot of the spatial music I would do isn't necessarily just electronic. It could be for choir, where the choir are all spaced around the audience. And I think this also is connected to my own experience of singing in choirs and that feeling of absolute immersion in harmony, which is one of the most spine-tingling things any of us can ever do. And anyone who sings in choirs probably knows what this is like, but that feeling of, I mean, recently I sang in Giroflée's Requiem, which is one of my favourite choral pieces of all time, and just the goosebumps you get from that is just incredible, and there's nothing like it. I don't get it from listening to it as much as I do from actually being in it.
As an experience. It. So the benefit of a spatial performance is that even the non-performer, the non-singer, has a propensity to feel the music more.
Exactly. And it's, I mean, for me, that's all about emotion and just instinct and how to make an experience even more memorable.
So Linda, I'm very interested, as you began to compose and have your work performed more, is there a point for you or a piece where you were beginning to feel things were coming together as one live performance or one piece where you thought, this is right, this is what I need to do?
I think possibly a piece called Chio, which is for symphony orchestra. And it was one of the first orchestral pieces that I'd worked on. And of course, a situation like that is always really daunting because you're writing for 80 or 90 musicians. And there's something about the simplicity of it in a way that I felt really, this was my very much true voice. I remember hearing the BBC Symphony Orchestra rehearse it in London. And I remember walking into the room and, you know, being sort of moved to tears when I heard them. And just that massive wall of sound when you have that many musicians in the room.
And what year was that, Linda?
That was 2012.
2012? So it's quite recent.
Mm. There's something very emotional about it because it starts off, as I said, an idea in your head, in maybe your bedroom or something. And then, you know, you're hearing it in this big concert hall and it's like you're sharing a part of yourself with so many people. And that is a really beautiful thing. It can feel overwhelming at times, but I feel so lucky that I get to share that, which has been, you know, a little spark of an idea in my head. And then it's fleshed out in its full form. And to hear that it manifests itself in the room with these people, it's really special.
And then beyond the orchestra, the impact it has on the audience. I mean, that was already happening in many other venues, but when it starts to happen in very big halls, it must be, from your perspective, quite a different experience to see a full concert hall experiencing your music.
I always love meeting audience members after concerts and talking to them, especially those who don't come from music backgrounds, and they might have very interesting ideas of what the music means to them. And oftentimes they'll say things like, oh, it really made me think of the sea, or it made me think of a forest, or they'll have a kind of pictorial images of it in their own heads. And this always fascinates me, is, you know, what it means to them, because of course it's so subjective, it's going to mean something very unique and different for each person, which I love, and I really welcome and love hearing those stories.
And that's one of the enormous strengths about the music genre that you're in, is that as an experimental sound, it's evocative, it has nostalgia around it. It also has shades, dark tones. So you can go in and experience whatever's in your own memory box because it's what's been triggered by it.
Absolutely. You know, I remember years ago reading a quote, I think by Björk, and she says, you have to make the music that you would want to listen to. You have to make the music that comes from you. And it's not about thinking about the audience or thinking about the listener. But if you, as she says, if you please yourself, then there's a very good chance that you will connect with other people. And there's something about that connection that I think is really important for me, actually. And it's not something that I necessarily think consciously about when I'm working, because I often get into a very kind of deep flow state of not knowing what time it is, and I get really immersed in writing. But it's kind of fascinating to me to think that those ideas did get translated through all those different levels. So first of all, it's coming from your head, and then it's going onto the page, and then the player is translating that, and then the listener is hearing that, you know. So it has all these different stages that it goes through.
It's like a 360 cycle from your head to their heads, an emotion to an emotion. Mentioning Björk also reminds me that you're a big fan of Björk.
Well, I think also for her sense of innovation, and that she's always trying out new styles and new genres, and it's such a deeply kind of emotional vocal performance that she gives as well.
And you've developed this relationship with Iceland quite specifically. I mean, you've been on residencies there.
Iceland is somewhere that I always felt a connection with, even far before I had ever gone there. And I stepped off the plane the first time that I went there, and I felt already a deep connection to the place, that it was something that almost came from a dream. But also it did remind me of where I come from, that sense of openness and really wide landscape, which you get in the more rural parts of Iceland.
When you've been talking about Iceland, it often feels that it's deeper than that, that it's a home from home, that it's calling you, whether it's lost DNA or it's ethereal, but that your affinity with it is, it seems not just landscape, but there's an oral connection. And you've composed work now using the Icelandic language.
That's right. I've always loved the sound of Icelandic as a language. There's something, I can't even describe it, there's something very kind of otherworldly about the sound of it. And I think coming back to years ago of listening to music like the Cocteau Twins and Elizabeth Fraser, who would sing in a way that is very difficult to understand as English, because it's not. And she's picking out words and she's improvising her own vocalizations. And the first time I think I heard Icelandic, it felt like that to me, because I wasn't able to necessarily understand it very clearly, but I just felt immediately drawn to it. And I've since used it in different choral pieces and in smaller vocal pieces as well.
And in a sense, that connection between place, sound and language is really interesting, because it brings us into the fact that even when I'm listening to your pieces and those voices singing in Icelandic, it doesn't seem to bother me that I can't understand it. It's an experience which goes way beyond comprehension.
I know, that's right. I mean, I remember years ago, I think one of the first pieces I wrote using Icelandic text was called Fall Approaches, or Haustid Nalgast, which is the Icelandic of it. And it's all about darkness coming, so waiting for winter, and then you're sort of knowing that you're not going to see much sunlight, and this kind of sense of despair almost, but then a sense of hope that you will emerge out of this darkness again. And I was working on ideas for the piece before I had a translation of the text. I just had the Icelandic of it, and I was just working out little sections of it. And even though I didn't understand what the meaning of it was, I always had to write it in the dark. I always had to write it at night. It just felt like any time I started to try and write it in the daytime, it just wouldn't happen. It would never work. And there was something about being drawn into that sense of winter or that sense of night that really carried through the composing of that whole piece. And once I finally got the full translation, I was like, oh my gosh, it makes so much sense. It was like the piece was leading me by the hand and telling me, you need to work on this in the nighttime. And it was the sense of kind of a nocturnal energy that it brought.
You're writing incredibly physical. It's method composition, that you're experiencing it even to the extent of the time and the place where you write the piece.
I think so. I mean, I'm not one of those people who will work on music 9 to 5. I know some friends of mine who can do that. It has to feel right. But there's also the thing of, you can't necessarily be sitting in a room and waiting for the muse to come. You have to make it happen as well yourself.
How do you make it happen?
Well, sometimes it can be as simple as getting away from it. Sometimes you can almost feel too close to it, and just to walk away and maybe go for a walk. Or like, I remember actually when I was working on the Chio orchestral piece, I had reached writer's block and I didn't know how to proceed with it. And I just took a walk and I came across a little bookshop with a book of haiku poetry, and I read some haiku texts by a female Japanese poet called Chio Ni. And there was one that really connected with me. Cool, clear water and fireflies that vanish, that is all there is. And it was just that sense of like one simple, clear, solid image. And I thought, okay, I know what the piece is now. It can't be about too many things. It's got to be about one very focused image that you carry through.
And so in terms of the work you've been doing, you've just recently composed a piece which relates to that last Icelandic residency, which was performed with the Vanberg and with Erla O'Leonard.
Well, the piece I wrote for Erla and the string quartet begun in Iceland, actually, and then finished in the Baltic Sea in a little island called Gotland. So it actually brought two of those worlds together. And in terms of landscape, they're actually quite similar, these two places. And again, I think I'm being drawn to something Nordic or something Scandinavian there by going to Sweden as well. And this island, Gotland, again, is very kind of wide and expansive and open, and it's looking out into the Baltic Sea. So it was actually a really transformative experience working with beautiful old Gaelic love poetry, all about love and loss, actually, and going back as far as the 7th century to the 11th to the 17th, up until the 20th century. I found a recurring thread between these poems, and they're all about that power of love and also the grief of loss. And the song cycle for Erla is all about that.
And this echoing then with the sea is part of it, right?
Exactly. And the title of the song cycle is O Iacht Amara, which is from a line of the poem by Kathleen Maud, O Riacht, which means entanglement. And this is all to do, it actually means from ocean's floor. So in this poem, which is a really beautiful poem, she wrote it before she died, quite young, of cancer. She talks about leaving her loved one behind and speaking to them from ocean's floor and saying, I'll still be with you and you need to get on with your life now. And so that the entire song cycle ends with that, which is very powerful.
And how important for you is collaboration? Because there's people who come back and forth in your work all the time, whether they are singers like Erla or other composers or orchestral groups. How significant is that for you to thrive?
It's really important for me, and also because composing can be a very solitary life. And as somebody who grew up with that many siblings. It would be strange for me to enter into a world where I'm on my own all the time. So for me, working with other people is really key to tapping into other parts of yourself that you may not tap into when you're on your own as well.
Because you're also a teacher, and that's something that I think you love.
I do. I think it's important for me in terms of interaction and just the kind of feedback I get from students. One of my favourite things ever is to play them a piece of music that they've never heard before and that they grow to become interested in, or they love it and they get really excited about it. Because I remember those feelings from when I was younger and hearing a piece of music for the first time and being blown away by it. And I kind of want to give those experiences back to students now.
And when you're teaching or you're in that environment with young composers or the wannabe composers maybe at that moment, what is your advice?
Well, my advice is be yourself, and also don't feel the weight of pressure of history on you. And I think there's something uniquely positive about being from Ireland, is that we don't have that kind of weight of history on our shoulders that you might have if you were a young composer in Germany or something like that, thinking of that massive legacy from Bach and Beethoven. For us, I think there's an atmosphere of inclusion. We're all quite supportive of each other. There's a really good sense of community. But what I would say to them is your set of influences are unique to you, and you'll filter them down into yourself. And don't be necessarily so worried all the time about, have I found my voice yet? That will come. You just have to trust in it and keep at it, actually, because you may not find your sense of self in the first or second or third piece, but down the line, you'll hear it. And when it emerges, it's very strong.
And for you, how comfortable is that sense of the found voice now in both your use of your own voice, but also the form, the type of music that you're composing? How settled do you feel?
It's always in flux. I don't think it's ever some kind of finite feeling. It's a sense of being curious about new music, new sounds, all the other art forms which filter in all the time. And I don't think that curiosity is ever going to go away. And I think that's one of the best things for me. In a way, I feel that I know what I'm drawn to in other musics and in my own music, but I don't think it stops there. I think it will be something that will be shifting and changing throughout my lifetime.
When you look at the work you've done, where or at which pieces might you say you're proudest of, if that's a fair question?
I think possibly the recent piece I did with Irla is up there because it felt so personal to me and it felt like it was something that I thought about doing for a long time and it really came together in a way far beyond what I'd even imagined. And I think also recent pieces that I've worked on with friends of mine like Kate Ellis, Jump for cello and electronics. There's something very kind of raw and visceral and energetic about that that shows a different side, which perhaps isn't so rooted in expansive landscape. This is something much more kind of gritty, I guess.
And you still go home, I mean, to Cork and Kinsale quite a bit. What do your folks, as you say, they're still working on the farm in their 70s, what do they make of their composing children, their musical family that came from that farm?
They think it's great. I mean, they are very grounded people and very humble people, so they would have instilled that in us as well, and they would keep you grounded, which is a great thing. So when I go home, I might still go out and go and get the cows. And this, I love that because that is something that's very physical, and it's not that you're sitting down in front of a manuscript and you're composing. It's something you're able to just take stock and you're able to breathe and walk out into the fields.
And what do they make of the music?
They haven't heard everything. Like, they've actually heard a lot of things on the radio through working with Lyric FM over the years. And they're very excited. Like, they sometimes would have the radio on in the milking parlour while they're milking. And
they'd hear. The cows like it.
Exactly. They find it relaxing.
Linda Buckley, thank you so much. And I hope all the sounds in our room and the atmosphere on Thomas Street has been inspiring you.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a podcast series, The Family of Things, from Athena Media. If you want to find out more or listen to other podcasts, go to our website, thefamilyofthings.com. And if you'd like to find out more about our guest, Linda Buckley, go to her site, lindabuckley.org.